It has been going a little bit under the radar because there's been so many other things in the news in the last couple of days, but there are some fairly major changes being rolled out this week when it comes to COVID-19 supports for private industry. The temporary wage subsidy scheme that we've known for the last 4 or 5 months is being abolished from next Tuesday. It's going to be replaced by an employment wage subsidy scheme, which is intended to try and provide slightly wider supports, but which will pay it at a slightly lower rate. To discuss that and some of the events of the last 10 days or so, we're joined on the line by the Sinn Féin TD for Donegal and the party's finance spokesman, Piers Doherty. Piers, good afternoon.
Good morning to you, or good afternoon, Gavin.
I know, it's always that delicate point at noon where you're never sure exactly which to say. The employment wage subsidy scheme taking effect on this Tuesday coming, the 1st of September. The government says that it will be perhaps slightly lower supports, but that it's designed to make sure that the comfort is spread more broadly across society to try and support more jobs across industry. What do you say?
Well, look, if we look at the positives for a start, first of all, that there is a scheme that goes beyond September, which is positive because businesses need them. And also the scheme now allows for seasonal workers to be employed. And that was an issue that was a big issue during the discussions of the temporary wage subsidy scheme, where many people were locked out. The problem is that there's many negatives in terms of this scheme. And I fear that it will lead to job losses within the sector. Because
what negatives?
What we have now is a lower amount of support to businesses. So the maximum amount that support is €203, whereas before this, there was a support of 85% of average net week payments up to a level just above €400. So there is a significant decrease for employers to continue to support their employees at this time. And crucially, in terms of the lowest paid employees, there is actually no support whatsoever for them. And this is something that we tried to deal with during the passage of this legislation. The legislation was guillotined and therefore didn't get a chance to discuss this in great detail. But we did highlight this to the minister. We had amendments down which we argued should have seen support of 85% of net weekly wages for those earning below €151.
Yeah, so if you earn €151 or less gross per week, now you're not going to get any subsidy at all.
That's exactly it. And when we talk about, you know, how many people are affected, there's 153,000 workers across the economy that earn below that figure. So therefore, none of these employees are entitled to, or their employers are entitled to, no support to continue these in employment.
But if your wage is that relatively low, surely the employer ought to be able to take on some of the burden and to at least cover as much of their wage as they possibly can without needing the state to support them when they earn that relatively little.
You would hope so, but that's not the reality that we live in at this point in time. So if you look at, of the 153,000 workers who earn below €151.50, 63,000 of them, or 61,000 of them, are actually availing of the temporary wage subsidy scheme at this point in time. So their employment is supported by the state. That ends on Tuesday. And, you know, these are people, and I gave the minister examples of this, that this is like your cleaner going into your restaurant. They're working a number of hours. They may hold 3 or 4 different jobs down, cleaning jobs down. They're working, you know, 5 or 6 hours per week in restaurants or in shops, you know, mopping the floor, very hard physical work, and then go on to the next job. Now, each of their employments will not be able to be supported because there's no support for them. And what we're hearing from, and we've heard from a large number of employers over the last number of weeks, is that they're being forced into decisions to try and keep their head above water. And the obvious choices that they're making is to let the employees go, which there is no support for.
So if the accusation or if the response from some would be that someone earning less than €150 per week could just claim job seekers allowance or apply for the pandemic payment, you're saying that because those people would usually work multiple jobs for that rate, that they'll still end up worse off?
And it's not just that. It's not about the individual here being better off in terms of on social welfare payments, and many of them would be able to claim the likes of family income support and so on and so forth. This is about trying to support our economy. This is about trying to keep people who are at work, who are low paid, connected with their employer. It is about also supporting the businesses that are struggling at this point in time. And you know what the government have done is simply cut off all supports for this cohort of workers. workers, these 153,000 employees. And that's, in my view, unfair. The minister would argue that, look, this is deliberate. This is an incentive. When this was put to him, he said that this was an incentive to for the employers to raise their wages or to give them more hours. However, that seems to be prohibited under the legislation, because if an employer artificially increases the wages of an employee for that period or gives them more hours just to get them above the €151.50 threshold, the employer is no longer an eligible employee, an employer. That means he loses all support, or she loses all support for all workers that they may have working.
So not even just the workers in question, that they would lose the support they get for their entire workforce.
Absolutely. So you could have 30 employees, which would all be supported by the state up to €203 per week. And if they artificially increase the wages or the hours of, let's take the cleaner, for example, to bring them above the level of €151, then all 30 employees would lose their support from the state. So there's huge risk there in doing that.
Is it too late to do anything about that? If this new scheme takes in on Tuesday, and obviously the Dáil isn't back to pass any legislation on Wednesday, is there any scope for the government to have a non-statutory support for those people, or is it totally blocked off now? They can't do anything for them?
Well, Gavin, what we've done is we've seen that in these pieces of legislation, including the temporary wage subsidy scheme, there's a kind of clause in it that this is all laid or it's given to the revenue commissioners to deal with this, the care and duty of the revenue commissioners. And as a result of that, they have huge flexibilities to actually stretch the legislation and even do things that the legislation doesn't say is allowed to do, as long as they know that the political system will fix it again through legislative change at a future point in time. So, of course, this can be done if the political will is there from the government to actually include low-paid workers in this scheme, then of course this can be done. But I can tell you, Gavin, that as we speak and over the last number of days, employers have notified employees that they are letting them go. So this needs to happen urgently. And there's a second issue with the supports, is that we're in a one-size-fits-all. So the type of support is there for any company who has a downturn of 30% or more projected over the next period of time. But not every company is the same. Pubs are different from other companies that may have a 30%. Some companies are looking at 80%, 90%. You know, if you're a tour operator, if you're in the hospitality sector, if you're in the coach business, if you're one of the wet pubs. And what we needed here was, and what we argued for, was the ability for the government to actually be more clinical, more specific in relation to supports that would be provided to certain sectors. Mm. So it wouldn't be a one-size-fits-all. It would provide additional supports for most affected.
I suppose the question, Pierce, is whether the state can continue to try and support industries on this kind of blanket indiscriminate basis, because one of the lines that we've heard so regularly said in the last few weeks is that it's only in the next couple of weeks people are going to realise just how unemployed they might be. But the state can't really go in and continually underwrite and support the wages of companies that are never going to recover, whose business models are you know, now fatally wounded by the existence of COVID-19, and who may have already been on something of a financial lifeline anyway. The state basically can't step in and support them forever. You can't continue to underwrite and viable business.
No, and nobody would expect that we'd use scarce public resources to underwrite a business that's going to fail anyway. And that's why we argued in the legislation that we needed to move away from a blanket approach into a more specific approach, which would allow for certain types of businesses to be supported more than others. But that isn't allowable under the current legislation. But like, there is also a moral responsibility on the state. Remember, the state is preventing, and rightly so, in many areas, certain types of activities, certain types of jobs coming back, and we see that in terms of wet pubs, we see that in terms of certain areas, in terms of tourism, and so on and so forth. And therefore, there is a responsibility while those businesses are closed down, while those employees are left unemployed, that the state continues to support them. And you know, they can't wash their hands from this here. There was commitments given that they wouldn't withdraw the supports until you know, stage four of the reopening of the economy, till everybody was allowed back up and running. That isn't the case. You know, certain companies are not allowed, certain businesses can't get back up and running because of public health guidance at this point in time, but the supports are being withdrawn from them. And these are viable businesses. These are businesses that continue to flourish when this pandemic is over, or when they can get back up and running again. The problem is that if the supports are withdrawn from them, these businesses will fail, they will close, and these employees will become not just temporary unemployed, but actually permanently unemployed, which is going to cost us a lot more as a society, but also as an economy into the future.
How important do you think is it that Ireland retain the EU trade portfolio when the new commissioner is nominated?
I think it's important. I think, as I said last week, that the government need to be liaison with the president of the commission, that it is a government decision, but they need to put somebody forward that has got the credibility and the capabilities of slotting into that position. It will be a decision ultimately for the president of the commission, but if a candidate of suitable quality is put forward, you would hope that she wouldn't try to reopen a complete reshuffle, because it's not as simple as, you know, reshuffling a cabinet here, Gavin, where the Taoiseach can just decide to change portfolios. In the commission, there has to be hearings at committee level and so on and so forth. So given the sensitivity of the time and the pressure, hopefully if somebody is put forward and proper engagement and lobbying is done, that we can continue to secure that position.
Is Simon Coveney an appropriately qualified candidate?
Look, you know, it is up to the government. There's a number of names, but obviously Simon Coveney is, you know, as a minister with that responsibility, is a name that's well known in Europe. But look, at the end of the day, this is a government decision.
Yeah, no, I get that it's not up to Dáil for approval or anything, but I'm just saying that if you believe that it's important that we nominate someone who has the prospect of retaining that role, do you think Simon Coveney is a suitable candidate for it?
Well, I think the EPP, as you know, which is the party that Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar are part of, and the president of the commission is part of, obviously they're well, Simon Coveney is well known to them, so I presume Simon, along with many others, would fit that, would fit the bill. But it's not as if that we don't have enough suitable qualified candidates. There are people within the civil service also that could fulfil that role, and now it's kind of a job for government, not only just to put forward a candidate and a name that's, you know, that's able to do the job, but also to make sure that the lobbying and the work goes on behind the scenes.
If it is so important for Ireland to retain the trade role, then was it right that Phil Hogan should have been forced out of the job?
Well, Phil Hogan was going to give up that job a couple of weeks ago. Gavin, I think he confirmed to the media that he was looking at leaving and looking at going to a position, a higher position in the World Trade Organization. And at that time, there wasn't a flurry of, Phil, you can't do this. How could you let us down? Because there are people, and you know, it's not about one person. There are people that can fulfil that role. And obviously, the Brexit negotiations aren't about the European Commissioner. It will be dealt with the team. And I think one of the things that stands to us, Gavin, in this country, is that we have political consensus in relation to our approach to Brexit. And I think that's that will survive the test of time.
So, do you think Phil Hogan's role had become untenable then in the last couple of days?
Well, obviously, that's why he resigned. He had lost the confidence, not only of the public, but of the people who put him there.
Well, no, he resigned because he said it was going to be an ongoing distraction, but he still said that he had broken no laws.
Yeah, well, but he lost the confidence of the public, but he also lost the confidence of the person who appointed him, his party colleague, Leo Varadkar. So when that position, when that unfolds, then it becomes untenable. And the issue, as we all know, is the drip feed of information. 11 different statements being released. Every statement that came out was contradicting or was the previous statement. So it did come to a position where, yes, I think he did the right thing, and he stood down. I think it was inevitable. At that point,
do you think he had broken some of the guidance on some of the rules on gatherings and the like?
I think obviously he did. I've said before that as the story unfolded, it became into, you know, where was Phil Hogan at this point and that point, and that's probably because he himself had made statements to the contrary. But the core issue here, I remember, was the knees up, the shindig, the golf outing and the dinner with the so-called great and the good, and that's what ragged the public. That's what the public got angry about. It was this idea that you have senior politicians and their friends, bankers, lobbyists, senior people in media, judiciary, all coming together. It's that idea of that cozy club at a time when there was significant lockdowns, and that, I think that was the point where Derek Cleary, in fairness to him, recognised that his position became untenable, and he did the honourable thing. He stood.
Well, he stood down because he was sitting at the cabinet table where they decided to impose certain limits or restrictions on movements and gatherings. And then a day later, he was found to have been party to a breach of some of those as well. But I suppose the reason I ask, and I'm sure you knew this question was coming, is that aside from the nature of the circles that the attendees moved in, a lot of people don't think that having an indoor gathering of 80, although against the rules, is all that much more or less defensible than having an outdoor gathering of 1,000 people at a funeral north of the border, at which you yourself had attended a few months previous.
Yeah, it was part of the funeral of Bobby Storey. Bobby was a friend of mine, and I was invited as the family to be part of the official 30 people, I think it was at the time, which were part of behind the coffin. And there was increased numbers in the church, which is allowable by the guidelines. As I said myself, I think I was concerned with the number of people who came out onto the streets. People coming onto the streets of funerals is a common thing, but in Belfast, there was a large number, and I was concerned in relation to that. But look, from my point of view, I didn't breach any guidelines, and I really think, and I've seen some of my political opponents trying to make a case of this here, I think that a funeral of a friend is no equivalence to an ease up, a shindig with the so-called great and the good, the kind of golden circle that happened.
And everyone would say that you're of course entitled to attend the funeral of a friend of your own, and if you are among the official party or the delegation of 30, then that's all well and good. But there were not only people who came out onto the street and others who followed the coffin, but also then there was a gathering at a cemetery, which wasn't even the cemetery at which your friend was being buried, which had set up with a PA system and with podiums, and which had over 1,000 people in attendance, which was clearly more than the 30 that was officially sanctioned by the rules at the time.
Yeah, and people did come to the cemetery as well. And one of the things that we tried to do to limit the number of people that were coming onto the streets was that we actually broadcasted the whole funeral online, and that's why you had PA systems and so on and so forth. And 250,000 people participated in Bobby Storey's funeral through social media, through Facebook, through Twitter, and other means. And that was an attempt by us to try and ensure that that people could be part of the funeral, but also not be present. But as I said, Gavin, and I said that at the time, I was concerned at the number of people who came out onto the streets or onto the footpath. We had stewards there to try and ensure that nobody came onto the street, and there was engagement with the PSNI in relation to the funeral's plans.
So if anyone says that because there had been a podium and a PA system set up at the cemetery, which as I said was not the one in which Bobby Storey was being laid to rest, you don't think that that is a sign of trying to cater to a large crowd? That's the audiovisual end of trying to put a production online.
Well, that's what happened. You wouldn't be able to record it unless you had some type of PA system in the cemetery. And as I said, for those who are trying to make equivalents from this and what happened with the golf outing, I think it's that there is no equivalence.
Okay, we will leave it there. Sinn Féin TD for Donegal and the party's finance spokesman in Leinster House, Piers Doherty. Thank you very much for joining us this lunchtime on the record.